you, Dr. Wilson, for coming to the committee this morning.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Paul Wilson. I'm the Director of Tax Research at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And I'm pleased to be able to be here today to talk to you about the tax expenditure budget report, tax expenditure report that we put out every 2 years. I was here a year ago to present it. We don't have a new report. This is the same report. It was done last year. So that's the report that I'll be talking about. Our tax research division has a lot of other materials that are useful for members of the legislature. I did put a one-page description of materials that are available on our research website in the back. I'm not sure if they got into members' hands or not. The one comment I would make just in the beginning, Madam Chair, is that the tax handbook that many of you are aware of becomes an essential resource if you want to look at taxes. It has a lot of information. You can answer many of the questions that you have about taxes, collections, history, rates, where the money goes, who collects it. In this document, the new version of this is being printed and delivered to us probably tomorrow, so you'll get it next week. And again, this is an extremely useful document that you, if you're on the tax committee in particular, you probably just want to keep it on hand. It's just an easy reference to answer a lot of questions. Today I want to talk about the tax expenditure budget. And the history of this report is that it's a legislative mandate. The report issued last year was the 12th Minnesota tax expenditure report. It was issued in February 1st of 2010. These reports are mandated by the 1983 by legislation 1983, authored by Representative Paul Ogren and Senator Eric Petty, and the first study was completed in 1985. They are issued on December 1st of even-numbered years. That's somewhat bizarre because even-numbered years are not in the budget year. So tax expenditure budget comes in out of cycle in some sense of the budget process, and that was a decision made a number of years ago by the legislature to put the incident study during the budget year. It's a major project, includes estimates of almost 300 separate items, uses a lot of our people, and most of the work has to be done over the summer and the fall of that year. What I want to talk about today in terms of an outline is first, why a tax expenditure report? Why do we do it? What is it for, basically? I want to talk a little bit about similar studies in other states, what information is included in our report. And then there was a mandated study last year that we're doing to be completed February 15th called the Tax Expenditure Review Study on how to set up a program to evaluate tax expenditures in the future. And then there are a few other issues that, time permitting, I can address. How do we define a tax expenditure? We often get questions about why some things are in and counted as tax expenditures and something else doesn't show up in the tax expenditure budget. How do we decide what is a tax expenditure? Second question, why don't we report the total dollars of tax expenditures in the report? We often get pressed, fiscal staff press us particularly hard. They wanted a number. Some of you wanted a number. What's the total tax expenditures for income tax? Just want to say a word about why we don't do that, but how you can come up with totals that might be useful. And finally, tax expenditure estimates differ quite a bit from revenue estimates, and I want to explain the difference between those two. But first of all, why a tax expenditure budget? Why do we do this? Why was this mandated that we do this study every 2 years? The statutory language says that it's to provide information on which sound policy decisions can be made. So it's designed to help in decision-making by the legislature. If the only goal of a tax system is to raise revenue, it's generally agreed that it would be best to have a very broad tax base and a low rate. If all you really cared about was revenue raising, there are tremendous advantages to having a broad base and a low rate. But that's not the only thing we do with our revenue system, with our tax system. We also want to do other things. For example, if you want to encourage home ownership, then maybe you want to have a mortgage interest deduction to try to encourage home ownership. If you want to recognize or reward combat veterans, then you create a combat credit. If you want to help farmers pay for bovine TB testing, then you can create a bovine TB credit in the tax structure. If you want to help people pay for child care, you can create a child care credit. If you want to help local governments, you can make the bonds that they sell tax exempt, the interest in those bonds, helping to keep interest rates low on those bonds. In each of these cases, the tax system is being used in a way that really is a substitute for a direct expenditure. In other words, you could design a direct expenditure to do some of these same things, using a tax expenditure to do them, or the tax system to do them and to accomplish those goals. And the idea of a tax expenditure is just to consider those provisions to be substitutes for direct expenditures. Tax expenditures, it ends up, are very different from direct expenditures, and you all know that. There's no line in the budget documents for a tax expenditure. You can't look in the budget documents and find out what the child care credit costs. It doesn't show up on the budget documents as a line. On the other hand, you can look and see what the sliding fee child care credit costs, I mean child care subsidies cost. It's a direct expenditure. It's a line in the budget. In addition, tax expenditures have no regular review process. There's no appropriations necessary. They're, in some sense, on autopilot. And so if they're on autopilot, then often they don't get reviewed in the same way that a direct expenditure program would get reviewed. They're authorized by different committees. So the tax committee tends to deal with tax expenditures. If you were doing direct expenditures for housing, for example, you'd be in a different committee generally than the tax committee. And it's much more limited public access to information. Tax information is generally confidential, and so you cannot get the same information about who is benefiting from a program as you would expect to get from a direct expenditure program. And, of course, there's a political difference. A tax expenditure reduces revenues. A direct expenditure increases spending. But given the need to balance a budget, there is a sense in which a tax expenditure has to result in either reduced revenue, reduced funding for other expenditures, or in higher tax rates. And so, again, the idea here is just that some things in the tax code are substitutes for direct expenditures. And the idea of a tax expenditure is to bring those into that perspective, to bring that perspective on to the tax expenditures themselves. Tax expenditure is not another term for tax loophole. Okay? Tax loophole is a pejorative term. Tax expenditure is not supposed to be a pejorative term. It's supposed to be a neutral term. We use the tax system to achieve some goals, try to achieve some goals. It may be warranted. It may be the best way to do that. It may not be. They may be designed well as tax expenditures. They may not be designed well. But the question is, so looking at it, calling it a tax expenditure is not saying something bad about it. It's just simply saying this is a deviation from the general rules in order to accomplish some other purpose. Sometimes tax expenditures are said to have a liberal bias. The whole idea is a liberal bias. And you can make that kind of a case sometimes, but I would argue that it's not a conservative versus liberal idea. The best example of the use of tax expenditure budget was the Reagan tax reform of 1987. And President Reagan basically put into effect a tax rate reform that broadened the tax base considerably and used the extra revenue to reduce the rate. In 1987, our income tax expenditures fell from 88 to 70. And in 1987, our tax return had only 19 lines on one page. We actually asked people to draw pictures in the blank space at the bottom of our tax returns. It was sort of a contest. Draw a picture. Draw something. Send it in to us because there's extra space on the tax return. Can you imagine such a thing when you look at today's tax return in Minnesota? Now, one reason why tax expenditures are sometimes viewed as a liberal idea is simply that the way they're reported in the tax expenditure budget is a dollar number. And people look at that as, we could raise this much money. We could raise $500 million if we get rid of this tax expenditure. It's viewed as a list of revenue raisers. Now, we could report it as in a different way, and I'll show that in a minute. We could do something different, but you could at least consider it as being how much could you drop the tax rate if you broaden the base. And that may be the offsetting way to look at it in terms of maybe removing some of the feel that it's a biased approach. I think there are really three uses of the tax expenditure budget, and all of you, each of you will probably come at it from a different direction, or at least some of you will come at it from different ways than others. There's the budget perspective, which is sort of a lot of economists come at it this way and say, look, We have a child care credit and we have a direct child care subsidy program. Let's look at the two together and decide which one works best. Are they really working well in concert, or could we redesign the mix somehow? So you take the tax expenditures and look at it as a budget line and say, a budget type, and say, what's the best way to pursue something for a particular kind of expenditure? A second perspective, a second set of lenses people use when they look at the tax expenditure budget is to look at it in terms of tax reform, the Reagan tax reform approach. Can we broaden the base and lower the rate? Okay, if we expand the base, how much can we get the rate to fall? That's really a tax reform perspective rather than a budgeting perspective. And the last perspective is, in a time with a $6.2 billion deficit, where can we find some money, which is really another different approach. None of these ways to look at tax expenditure is wrong, budget is wrong, but just realize that you can look at it in different ways. You can look at it through different lenses when you look at the results. The number of tax expenditures is about 300, and they're in all tax types. So when you look at the publication, you'll see that while most of the tax expenditures are for the individual income tax and the sales tax, we also have chapters in there for the excise taxes, gambling taxes, air flight property, local property tax, insurance taxes. So all tax types basically are covered in this, in the study. There are two tax types that have not been in the past that probably should have been, which is the state property tax and the Minnesota care tax. But basically, the report is designed to include all tax types. And this is an example of a page out of a report. This is from page 59 of the report. And this is home mortgage interest. And I know you probably can't read this. If you have a copy of the report, if you want to turn to page 59, you can look at the actual example or the handout. Maybe you'll be able to read it. But if you look at this, you'll notice that this is home mortgage interest. So this is an itemized deduction for home mortgage interest. What information do we provide on that tax expenditure? Well, first, we have a legal citation. Where can you find the law on this? Both the Internal Revenue Code, where can you look in the Internal Revenue Code to find the law about mortgage interest deduction, and where can you look in Minnesota statutes to find where this is put into effect in Minnesota? Secondly, there is a description of the current law. This is very useful when you want to know, well, wait a minute, exactly what mortgage interest is deductible. You get a very brief description in here of how it works. What is deductible? What isn't deductible? What limits are put on these kind of things? Third, there's the history. When was this enacted? When was it last changed? What's going to happen in the future if something's going to expire? So you get a history of what the changes were that relate to this tax expenditure. The number affected, in this case, the deduction reduces the state income tax on an estimated 733,000 returns in 2009. When we have that kind of information, it's provided in the tax expenditure budget. So how many people are going to be affected by this tax expenditure? And the dollar impact at the bottom. Now, the dollar impact is stated in dollars, so in 2011, it's $418 million. All that's saying is that basically the benefits of this are $418 million. It reduces taxes by about $418 million for the taxpayers who claim it. Again, we could state that in a different way. On your sheet, you'll see it says, a note for tax year 2011, a 0.1 percentage point change in all three tax rates. 5.35, 7.05, 7.85 are our three tax rates. If you drop them all by 0.1%, so it would be 5.45, instead, 5.25 instead of 3.5, 6.95 instead of 7.05, et cetera. If you drop them all by a tenth of a percent, you'd give up $109 million in revenue. So you could look at this as the equivalent. If you want to look at it in terms of how much could we drop the rate, how big is this in some sense, you could drop the rate by about four-tenths of a percent in all three brackets. That's how big this is in terms of narrowing the base for the tax. Now, again, the information is just what you have here is just information. You notice there's no value judgments made in this page. The Tax Expenditure Report in Minnesota has not been an evaluation tool. It simply gives the facts, just the facts, no evaluation in there at all. I want to say more about that in a second. 41 states and D.C. have tax expenditure reports. It actually may have gone up by one. Georgia now has one as well. And our report has been lauded by those who look at these as being one of the better reports. Oregon, Minnesota, and Connecticut published relatively comprehensive informative reports, et cetera. That could be a model for the states. They have the group that did the Center for Budget Public Policy, Public Priorities is who is quoted here. But they have a bunch of criteria for how they would evaluate tax expenditure budgets. What makes a good one? What makes a bad one? They should be public regularly. They should be found online. They should cover all major taxes, et cetera. A bunch of criteria, and these are organized so all the Minnesota yeses are at the top and the noes are at the bottom. And I just want to focus the first box here, the box on red, the fourth, fifth, and sixth one. These are things that we do that a lot of states don't do in their tax expenditure budgets. We include the cost of exempting services from the sales tax. A lot of states do not include that. They don't include services at all in their tax expenditure budget because services are not generally thought of as part of the traditional base of a sales tax. So we're a little bit, we're not unusual, but half the states with the sales tax don't do that in their if they have a tax expenditure budget. We include federal exemptions and deductions as tax expenditures. So the mortgage interest deduction shows up as a tax expenditure in our law, even though it's really the federal law that we're just picking up. A lot of states don't do that. More than half the states who have an income tax don't include the federal items, which means you wouldn't find the mortgage interest deduction in their report or the impact of that in their reports. Again, there are states who don't adopt the federal itemized deductions. Wisconsin doesn't. You can make credits instead. You can have different ways of handling these itemized deductions. So in some ways, the decision by the state to just piggyback on the federal law is an acceptance of that, and you could look at other alternatives, which is why we include it. And our estimates are forward-looking. 2011 through 2013 or 2010 through 2013 in last year's report, some states only look backwards, which doesn't do you much help for knowing what the numbers are going forward. On the other hand, there are certain things we don't do in our report. It says the second one in that box includes program categories for each expenditure. We don't identify it as this is the purpose of this is housing, or the purpose of this is to help low-income families. We maybe should do that, but we don't do that, have not done that in our past reports. Some states list the purpose or rationale of each tax expenditure. You notice under mortgage interest deduction in that example, nowhere do we say why we have it. We just say we have it. So the purpose is not stated. Some states state a purpose for that. If you're going to evaluate these things, you'd obviously have to have a purpose. And the next one says includes the evaluation of each expenditure. We don't do any evaluation of tax expenditure reports. We've not done that in any reports. Again, it's not clear the Department of Revenue is the right one to do that evaluation, but it's not been done in our reports. And we don't show any distribution of benefits by income level. Now, we did do a study 2 years ago for the House and did a lot of that work, but we don't include it in the tax expenditure budget directly. I have two slides here that show things on distribution that we did produce for the House of Representatives Tax Committee. The first one is the mortgage interest deduction. We presented it in a way that is not necessarily the only way you could do this. We presented it by deciles from the tax incidence study, the poorest 10% versus the richest 10% of Minnesota households, and 41% of the benefits went to those in the top 10% of Minnesota households. Again, this could be presented in different ways. This is the way that they had asked us to present it. Similar information was provided for 16 income tax and 14 sales tax items. It says last year, but it really was 2 years ago now. And they're included in a publication from the House called A Review of Selected Tax Expenditures, a presentation to the House Tax Committee. Here's an example of clothing, sales tax on clothing. So I'm not going to talk about those, but we don't do that kind of thing in the tax expenditure budget. This was done on a special one-time basis. In response to what we don't do, last year the House and the Senate passed and the governor signed a bill that in the omnibus tax bill, a provision that requires us to do this year a tax expenditure review study due in just a few weeks, okay? And that study, we were told to define the reference tax base for each tax. What is it that deviations from are considered tax expenditures? What is the baseline? What is the starting point against which we evaluate tax expenditures? To identify additional information not in the current tax expenditure budget that's needed to evaluate tax expenditures and that maybe we should add. To recommend an ongoing process for reviewing tax expenditures, including a timetable and priorities for those evaluations. And to identify other ways to bring tax expenditures into the regular budget process, such as sunset requirements. This report will be released about February 15th. We have used a group of six tax experts from outside the department to come in and help us with this study. They're working very part-time, but they have been meeting with us to respond to the fact that things we don't do. We don't do evaluations. Our tax expenditure budget is not part of the budget process. what additional information would be needed, and how could those evaluations be structured if the legislature wanted to structure them? So this is a report to the legislature due shortly. There were two other law changes last session that are important to note. One thing that some of you may not realize, but law last year says that all new or extended tax expenditures must include a statement of purpose and a standard against which its success may be measured. This is in law. So any of you who are putting new tax provisions in that would reduce tax, that would be considered tax expenditures, the law says you have to state a purpose and describe a standard against it which it can be measured. And those of you who are in the property tax local government aids and property tax subcommittee know that there's a new approach to evaluating, new evaluative approach that's taking place on property tax. Any tax revenue estimate for property tax provisions. It doesn't apply to the other taxes.
Dr. Wilson, excuse me. Can I ask you about how that would work? For instance, there is a bill that's been introduced into the legislature this year that would exempt cities, counties, and school districts from paying sales tax on their purchases. Under the new law, would then we need to include a statement of purpose and a standard for measuring the success for that change?
Madam Chair, that would be my understanding. I mean, obviously, you want to check with your legal folks, but that's my understanding of what it means, is that if you pass – I'm sorry, you're – Yeah, if you put in a new exemption like that, you'd need to state a purpose and have some way of measuring whether it is succeeding in its in pursuing its goal.
And, Doctor, do we have some proposed measurements or standards by which we could measure success?
Madam Chair, in the property tax area, some work has been done on that, but no. The report we put out will talk about different criteria, but basically the criteria will be different for each one. I mean, the purpose of each of these would be different. So if the mortgage interest deduction is the purpose to increase home ownership, that would be what you'd say, and then I don't know how you do measurement. But
Doctor, so in that example, it might be to relieve some of the financial burden or stress on our cities, counties, and school districts, but your February 15 report that comes out, will that have some potential criteria for us to use when we consider these proposals?
Madam Chair, not really. The report is to talk about how it could be done, but not to do evaluation. And so it doesn't set up criteria. It does talk about some possible criteria, but in terms of the one you're talking about, there'd be nothing in that report to help you state what the goal is. The one thing I would say is you can state goals in a way where they have to be satisfied. The goal is to help local governments. Well, by definition, that'll be satisfied. So do you want a goal stated that's more specific than that?
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, Dr. Wilson, back on another slide there. No, I'm just one back. But we were talking about the law of the stated purpose. It says a standard to which success may be measured. So we come up with a standard, but do we ever go back and measure the success? I mean, it doesn't look like there's anything in there that says, so we have the standard, and doesn't seem like there's a review process of whether or not it's achieving its goal.
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair and Senator, The language in the bill last year was the outcome of work done to try to set up an evaluation process. And so the bill not only did that, but it also set up required us to do this report. And the report will talk about how that could be done. But you're right. There's nothing in the language from last year that says specifically how you would evaluate it.
Thank you.
How do we know if it's a tax expenditure? There are some very specific criteria in the tax expenditure budget. They're not the only way to define what's a tax expenditure, but some things are considered tax expenditures and some things are not. The idea, let me just read through these quickly, but we only include taxes that apply statewide, so a local sales tax in a city is authorized as a special tax, and those are not included. The local property tax is statewide, so it is included in the study. The provision must provide preferential treatment. we have argued that the standard deduction and the dependent exemptions are not preferential treatment because they are the same amount to every individual. That's the way that the federal government treats it in their tax expenditure budget. So some things are treated, you know, it's sort of a value judgment to some extent as to whether those are tax expenditures or deviations or are part of the baseline tax system. We have in our report, we don't include items that don't have a revenue impact. So that the example here is that a better example may be CAR-Z, which was enacted last year. If nothing is done with the Ford plant that qualifies for CAR-Z, that won't have a cost, and we wouldn't show it even though it is in law. So we've just excluded the ones that don't have any cost from the report. And there's no list of them in the report either. It's not subject to an alternative tax. You know, we exempt motor vehicles from the general sales tax, but they have their own sales tax. We exempt cigarettes from the sales tax, but there's an in lieu sales tax. So if there's another tax in lieu of what they are exempt from, we don't consider that tax expenditure for the sales tax. The next bullet says it's not counted as a direct expenditure. The property tax refund, some people would say, well, isn't that a tax expenditure? But that has its own line in the budget documents. It's already an appropriation. So even though in some ways it looks like a tax expenditure, if it were included on the income tax return, it would be a tax expenditure probably because it wouldn't have its own line. But since it is already in the budget documents and is already going through the appropriations process, it's not included in our report. Nor is the political contributions credit, which again has its own appropriation, its own line in the budget. And finally, the legislature has to have the authority to post tax. We don't include the exemption for federal bond interest because the federal government says we can't tax it. If we can't tax it, it's not a tax expenditure that we can do. We don't have any control over it. You don't have any control over it. So we don't include it in the report. But the most important thing is it's got to be a deviation from the reference tax base. So what is the normal tax base? What is the reference tax base? There's no good term for this because you're not saying it's the best tax base, but what's the reference tax base? Deviations from which become tax expenditures. For income taxes, we define the income tax as an tax on income tax defined as income from all sources less expenses that are reasonable and necessary to generate that income. What does that mean? Well, that means that an income tax should allow deduction for true depreciation of assets. And if you have accelerated depreciation that's faster than true depreciation, that accelerated depreciation is considered to be a preference, and as a result, it's considered to be a tax expenditure. We assume that personal dependent exemptions, again, the standard deduction are part of the regular structure. The graduated rates are considered part of the regular reference structure, so you don't have a tax expenditure for the lower rate or something. For corporate tax, equal weight apportionment and the throwback rule are both included in the reference tax base. Some of you might have strong opinions about that if you understand. Those of you who know what those are may have strong opinions that in fact, is not the basis that you would define as a reference tax. But that's how it's defined for the purpose of the study. In sales tax, states differ tremendously in how they define the reference tax base. We already said, are services part of the tax base? Tax expenditure budget says they are. It's goods and services, not just goods. But what about business purchases? Some states in the tax expenditure budget include purchases for resale, an exemption for purchases for resale. They include that as a tax expenditure. We don't. We assume that that's – you would just do that. You're not going to tax something and then tax it again when it's sold at retail. And so we don't include that as a tax expenditure. We consider that part of the reference tax base. On the other hand, capital equipment exemptions are considered to be tax expenditures because the definition that we use in the study is that the base includes all final purchases of tangible goods and services, and nobody buys that capital equipment later. So capital equipment types of purchases are considered, if you exempt them to be tax expenditures, you wouldn't have to define it that way. Most economists view the sales tax as a consumption tax. It ought to tax consumption. If it's a consumption tax, then a business purchase of capital equipment would not be considered part of the reference tax base. So realize there's some judgment here, and there are a lot of tax expenditures in the sales tax area, which are business purchases, that someone who says it should be a consumption tax would not, in fact, include in the study. So again, there are value judgments here. Oh,
excuse me, Doctor. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Dr. Wilson. So you're saying that the omission of services in our sales tax structure is a tax expenditure, and that's why you report on it separately?
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, in general, in sales tax, the way the sales tax is, the way the sales tax statutes are written, all goods are considered taxable unless they are specifically exempted. Mm-hmm. All services are considered non-taxable unless they are specifically taxed.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
But so we would consider, for example, the exemption for auto repair labor services. We would consider that to be a tax expenditure. It's listed in the report. It's a service. Traditionally, sales tax, a lot of people think of the tax, it should just be on goods. I mean, there's sort of a history of it being a tax on goods. The share of goods in our economy has dropped tremendously through time. And so, you know, maybe not including services as part of the tax in 1930 was a good idea. Maybe not in 1967 when our tax was first introduced. But still, it's grown greater. And so we just, in the report, we do include them. Again, we sort of err on the side of including something as a tax expenditure if we think it's somewhat on the border. But we've just defined those to be in. So
thank
any
you.
Service that's not taxable is in the tax expenditure budget.
Okay.
We did, for the first time in the last study, separate purchase of business services from purchase of consumer services. And so you can see the two different parts in there. And
thank
the
you.
Business services might be more questionable than the consumer services. Anyway, so the first question was what's included. How come some things aren't listed, some things are as tax expenditures? And there are judgments. The introduction to the report is short, and it talks a lot about that. A second question we get asked a lot is, why don't you show totals? I mean, you got all these numbers in there. Why make us add them all up if we want a total? Why don't you just put a total at the bottom of the page or at the bottom of the section? And we don't do it for several reasons. The first is that you can't simply sum them up because there are interactions between them. If you were to repeal one item, one tax expenditure, and repeal another one, if you did them separately, you'd have costs for each one, and that's what's reported in the tax expenditure budget. If you do them both together, you may have a different revenue impact than if you did them separately, than the sum of doing them separately. So there are interaction effects when you do more than one thing. And so you can't just add them up. Some people found that out somewhat to their dismay when you put bills in, and you have an estimate for one thing, and you have an estimate for another thing, and then you say, well, I want to do both, and you find out that the estimate comes in lower than the sum of the two, because when you do both, the two provisions interact with each other. And I'll say something. Sometimes there are negative interactions, sometimes there are positive interactions. I'll say it's a little bit about it, although I'm going to have to skip some of the slides, but I do want to give one example. For sales tax, the list is just incomplete in the tax expenditure budget. We don't have everything in it, and I'll give some examples in a minute of where they are, some things that are left out in the sales tax list, things that probably should be considered tax expenditures. We just don't put a number in there for them. And we also are a little wary of totals because some things we probably couldn't do. In the income tax area, there are some items that are listed in the tax expenditure budget that I don't know that the department could administer if you repealed them. We couldn't actually tax these things effectively. Often it's just information problems. We wouldn't have any information, or even the taxpayer might not have the right information to report the amount unless someone reported it to them. And if the feds aren't taxing it, then it's not being required to – the feds aren't requiring it be reported. Just one quick example of why things are not additive. If you look in the tax expenditure, these are the itemized deductions. Itemized deductions on the income tax – the big one there is home mortgage interest, $418 million was the one-year cost impact of that. The second one up is charitable contributions, $202 million. The third is real estate taxes, your property taxes on your home, $184 million. Medical expenses, $64 million. If you add all of them up, you get the number at the bottom, which is the $880 million. If you just add them up, you get $880 million. But if you were to repeal all of the itemized deductions altogether, not that anybody would do that, but if you were to do that, just repeal them all, you wouldn't pick up $880 million. You'd only pick up $637 million. And you can understand why, because why do you itemize? You itemize because your itemized deductions are higher than your standard deduction. Once you start taking itemized deductions away from people, they become standard deduction people. And once they become a standard deduction person, you can't take anything more away from them because they still keep the standard deduction. So if you think about taking these away, you basically take them away, and as soon as people become a standard deduction, you can't hurt them anymore. And yet, if you took something else away first, they would be hurt. So you just can't add them up. There's a negative interaction that reduces the cost by 27.5. So you add up the numbers, the tax expenditure budget, you may get too high a number in this way.
Dr. Wilson, we have about 10 minutes left. We also have to hear this morning from Tom Gillespie, the state demographer, when you're done. So
yes,
if you could.
I understand. There are a lot of positive interactions in the system, too, things where if you do two things, it'll cost, you know, the impact is larger than the sum of the two numbers. But if we just move on to, if you look at slide 21, I mentioned that a lot of sales tax items are not included. I just want to point out, item 418 on page 108 of the report is selected services. And there we have a lot of estimates of what the revenue impact is of exempting a lot of services, what you could, in some sense, what is at stake if you tax them. It's not really a revenue estimate, but it's an estimate of the size. And in that list, we don't show medical services. We don't show housing services. We don't show educational services. Medical is very big. There is a 2% provider tax on medical services, but, of course, the sales tax is 6.5%. So, you know, in some theoretical sense, it maybe ought to be in the study, but it's not in there. So if you want a total, would you want a total without the medical services? Again, the totals are a little bit misleading if you look at that, if you try to get totals. We have done some work. I think you really can almost add them up and come up with a reasonable total because the positive interactions are greater than the negative, and so you probably could add them up and have an underestimate. This page just shows, you know, this is something that was worked out with fiscal staff 2 years ago, but if you want to know what the individual income tax total would be, if you added them up and adjusted downward for the itemized deduction, you have a lot of positive ones that be added to that. But it's equal to about 63% or more of total collections. So the tax expenditures, the impact of the tax expenditures is about 63% of total collections, if you want to know how big they are generally. And in the sales tax, it's like 120% of collections. So you could more than double collections if, in some sense, somebody put everything in, even without medical services in there. Just one final comment. Unlike revenue estimates, in the tax committee, you're used to seeing revenue estimates. Tax expenditure numbers are not revenue estimates. So when you, if you look at the tax expenditure number and then you decide, oh, I'll put a bill in that will get rid of that, you may find you get a very different number than what the tax expenditure budget shows. And I just want to mention a couple reasons why they're different. In other words, tax expenditure budget numbers are estimates used for certain purposes, but they're not really the same thing as what you could raise. One reason is because those estimates are somewhat old now, having been done more than a year ago. But there are other reasons, too. The tax expenditures ignore interactions among provisions, whereas we'd have to take those into account in a revenue estimate. They ignore any impact on other taxes. So if you change vehicle registration taxes, if something goes up or down vehicle registration taxes, that changes our income tax collections. That's not taken into account in tax expenditures, but it would be in a revenue estimate. And for revenue estimates, the effective dates really matter. The tax expenditure budget shows things by fiscal year, but if you change the law, you're not going to pick up all that revenue in the first fiscal year. In sales tax, you generally have a month delay before collections start because we get the money a month after it's paid by the consumer. In corporate, a lot of the money is pushed back until the second fiscal year. So again, effective dates really can make a difference in the numbers. And in addition, the tax expenditures generally don't take collectability into effect. Our estimate for publications exemption from the sales tax doesn't take into account the fact that some of those magazine sales are from companies that we couldn't collect from legally. They wouldn't be required to collect. Now, technically, the people who buy the subscriptions, some of them should be paying use tax, but the collectability issue is not taken into account either. So in conclusion, tax expenditure budget, I would argue, includes a lot of useful information for you. There are different ways to look at it, different perspectives. And you should read the short introduction if you want a sort of a good summary of how things are defined and what the limitations of the numbers are. And the tax expenditure review study will recommend some changes in the tax expenditure budget next time around, along with recommendations on an evaluation process, sort of taking into effect the question was asked earlier about, you know, how would you actually, there's nothing in law now. Well, you could, this is sort of saying, making recommendations for how you might try to do that if the legislature wanted to do that. The final slides just show counts of tax expenditures. It's sort of interesting history there. Counts are not a good way to measure the impact of tax expenditures because some are tiny and some are big. But you'll see a couple notes in the bottom that are sort of interesting in terms of trends. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm finished.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quickly, Dr. Please help me understand where it's to you, actually, to the Senator's question earlier about sales tax by local units of government, how Minnesotans can be taxed, property tax, when they purchase items for county use, they pay a sales tax to the state of Minnesota. How can it be different if the state of Minnesota on collection of taxes is exempt from paying taxes? Is that pretty clear?
Madam Chair, Senator
Dr. Gretchen, Wilson.
The state does pay sales tax on state purchases. Interesting enough, that's not showed up, that doesn't show up in the state in the tax expenditure budget, because we would say it doesn't have any revenue impact because the state's paying itself. But if we exempt local government purchases, certainly that has an effect on state revenues. Now, you might argue it's going to raise property taxes, certainly, sure. But the tax expenditure budget is only saying, what does this do to state revenues? That's the question it's addressing. It's not looking at what it does down the road. But it would reduce state revenues. That exemption would reduce state revenues.
Senator Ingebretson.
And just a quick follow-up. Maybe this would help. With regards to constitutional amendment dollars, maybe that's where I should have brought that up to start with. It was a ruling that we were not able to pay in lieu of taxes with those dollars, turn around and basically pay the state of Minnesota taxes because they've already collected it with regards to that additional sales tax.
Sure.
That's only an opinion, but I guess how does that stand throughout your studies?
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebretson, if in fact a determination was made that you could not, that the constitutional amendment did not allow that to be paid, then we would say obviously that exemption for that part would not be a tax expenditure because we would be constitutionally, we take a limit in the Constitution, we'd say that the legislature doesn't have the authority to take action on that, and so we would not include it for that 3/8%. I'm not aware of a determination of that, but again, if that were determined to be true, then it's basically a legal question, and the court could certainly decide that. We should make an adjustment if they do.
Thank you, Dr. Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, Dr. Wilson, you talked earlier about tax policy trying to encourage behavior like mortgage deduction, and it seems like we have a lot of counterproductive taxes. For instance, if we have a mortgage deduction, we're trying to encourage home ownership, but then we give a renter's credit, certificate of rent paid. Are we trying to encourage rentership? I mean, it seems that why would you buy a house if you're getting a credit? And if you eliminated that or reduced that, would that have an encouragement for people to buy a house? So I was just wondering if you could explain what the rationale was for the renter's credit, if you know.
Dr. Wilson, if you have a comment on that.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think that, I mean, one point I would make is just that if we were evaluating the tax expenditures, one thing we need to do is take into account in the evaluation, you have to take into account the other programs that are out there that may be, in fact, hindering or offsetting the effects of it, so that certainly in an evaluation of the mortgage introduction, we take that into account. But in terms of the rationale for the renter's credit, I think it's fairly clear that the intention there is to help people with low income pay for housing costs. Whether it's a good idea or not is something that, but I mean, that's the intention basically. To some extent, it could be interpreted to offsetting property taxes on that they're paying indirectly through their rent. So you refer to it as renter's credit. I think officially it's a property tax credit for renters. So it's meant to offset the property taxes that are included in the rent in the same way that property tax is included in the house. But, of course, in the case of the homeowner, we know what the property taxes are. In the case of the renter, you need to make an estimate and that percentage has been decreased, obviously, from 19% to 15% in the last couple of years. I think that's right, in the last few years. So I think maybe thinking about it as the property tax offset maybe more correct than just saying it's to help low-income renters.
Senator Roblings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, this book is really interesting. When you have time to read through it, I just want to point out, like starting on page 100, we have 44 pages of exemptions for the sales tax. And a lot of them are the ones you just assume are out there, you know, the clothing and food and medical devices. And but some of them get very interesting as you go along, you know, like sacramental wine. And that isn't from the purchasers, it's from the seller. And then there, even under local governments, there is a, even though we say we tax purchases by local governments, there's a whole list on page 123 of things we don't tax for local governments. School districts don't pay taxes, hospitals and nursing homes, libraries, fire trucks, ambulances, and patrol cars are exempt, motor fuel for those vehicles, ambulance medical supplies, repairs for certain vehicles, landfill machinery, correctional facility, construction materials, town road maintenance equipment. So we have a lot of exemptions there, and I'm sure they were all brought in probably almost one at a time as bills by a legislator who thought it was a good idea or whose local governments or associations came forward. Things like institutional meals sold at the college campuses are not taxed compared to when you would go into a restaurant and buy something. Admission to athletic artistic events, to the Minnesota Zoo, school admission to school-sponsored events, YMCA memberships. I mean, you can think of all of the years it took to accumulate these 44 pages of exemptions. And then you have to think, are they serving the purpose we want or not? So, you know, I'd like to assign a little homework, and maybe we have another joint hearing next Thursday. Maybe we could all come back and talk about the one that they found the most interesting. I think that would be really, really enlightening to go through here and not necessarily the one they found the most worthless, although that might be interesting too. But, you know, come back with questions. Why do you think that one got in here? How did we explain this one? Because as we heard, there really isn't an explanation of why. It just explains the history of the program a little bit, but it doesn't really tell you why, and there is not an evaluation. And we also heard that these are not routinely evaluated because they are not line items on our spreadsheets. And I think it is time to look at these and do some evaluations of them. And so please spend some time with this.
Well, I would just add to that, Senator Roebling, that it's not as clear or clean as we might think, and I'm sure Dr. Wilson would support this, that when we say that we technically don't tax services, well, we actually tax many services, and we tax things like dry cleaning services or certain types of landscaping services. So it's not as clean and clear as you might think that we only tax goods and not services. Those lines are not as clear as we might think, and so that's another way to look at this and say, why are certain services taxed and not other services taxed? And I hope that when we come back next week, we'll also talk about Minnesota's competitiveness on the sales tax. When you add in all these exemptions on that or the corporate income tax, it actually forces the rates up higher for those that pay, because we're taking people off of the base and asking others to pay for the government that is supported by the funds. And so I think we should look at that. And in fact, you know, our sales tax rate in Minnesota is close to 7%. In South Dakota, they tax everything, but it's 4%. Wisconsin is 5%. And so we should be looking at our competitiveness on this. We should be looking at the overall purpose of what we're trying to accomplish with our sales tax and in all of our taxes where we have exemptions, because I'm not convinced that our picking winners and losers here at the state capitol is the best practice, and we might want to look at that, reconsider that as well. So additional homework for Senator Roebling and for all members. Senator Langseth, and then Senator Ingebretson.
When you compare states, it isn't comparing apples and apples either, because many states have a lot of piggyback taxes. I think I was in Colorado, and I think it was 4% was their tax rate, and I paid 7.5%. So I think if you're going to make comparisons, you got to compare the large cities in the states with, because we really don't have much in the way of the piggyback sales. Many states have very large, sometimes counties and cities will have it, and so on. So when it comes to competitiveness, it's what people pay.
Right, and Senator Langseth, I appreciate that. I think that's why many of us are on the tax committee, because we love those kinds of comparisons and trying to figure all that stuff out. It's very, very interesting. I would note that for the members, that if you add in the local sales taxes, our sales tax on average in the state of Minnesota is 7.22%, and we way outpace our neighbors. So something to think about before our next hearing next week. Senator Ingebretson, and then Senator Bonhoff, did you also have a question or comment? Senator Ingebretson.
No question.
Okay. Dr. Wilson, we thank you, and we will hope that you might be able to join us again next week. And also, members, Tom Gillespie, our state's demographer, is here. And welcome to the committee, Mr. Gillespie. Thank you for joining us today. For tax committee members, while Mr. Gillespie is getting set up, I just want to let you know about next week's tax committee hearings. On Tuesday morning at 8:30, we will have a property tax overview. The Department of Revenue staff will be joining us for that. On Wednesday, we'll have the morning off. There will be no hearing. And then on Thursday, we'll have that joint hearing with finance that we just talked about. We have two presentations, one on the state rankings and comparisons on taxes and spending. And that will be presented by the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, and Budget Trends with Budget Trends Reform Commission. And our former Commissioner Kevin Goodnow, who was a co-chair, will be there here to present that as well. So, Claire, did you want to talk for a minute about next week's
Finance Committee? We have the Thursday joint hearing with the Tax Committee. And then on Tuesday, we are hearing several education bills. And Wednesday, we don't have anything scheduled yet, but stand by. Don't fill it up just yet.
Thank you, Senator Roebling. Mr. Gillespie, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Minnesota Department of Administration. In the interest of time, if it meets your approval, I will jump to sort of cut over the first third of the presentation, which is was mainly focused on the impact of the recession on demographic change, and focus in on going forward and looking at some of the revenue and expenditure impacts of demographic change over the next decade, but focusing heavily on some of the nearer term events. We have been talking in the state for many years now. I can go back to at least 30 years when we began talking about some of these issues, and I know there are members of this body that I've talked with quite extensively about some of the issues, about some of the big demographic changes that would happen in the future. Well, that future is now here, and the long run has become a short run issue. These are exciting times for demographers, unfortunately, that there are very large and dramatic things happening in our society. The largest of which is that we have entered a period in our national and state history that has been long referred to as the future age of entitlements. And one of the implications of that is that over the next 25 years at least, economic growth is going to be slower, revenue growth will be slower, and we are beginning a decade of unprecedented change. And this, Minnesota is not an exceptional state. We are, in fact, very close to the national average when it comes to our age structure, and will experience very much of the same changes that our nation will experience. And some of the changes in the United States and in Minnesota are not exceptional either, since much of the world is experiencing many of the same changes. The financial events of the past year in Europe are directly related to this. They are older than we are, and they are about a decade ahead of us in this process. And we can take that as instructive, as an instruction as to what is potential in change over time. Japan is ahead of Europe. They are older than Europe. Their workforce is declining. Their population is declining. And Japan's credit rating was downgraded this morning. And that will not be the last that we will hear about that. Japan has one of the highest debt ratios of sovereign debt ratios in the world. China right now is younger than we are. Within 5 years, they will be older than us. And by 2017, their workforce begins to decline. Dramatic things are happening in the world, and this is very much of a global issue. The essential element in Minnesota and the United States is that the baby boom generation begins to turn 65, well, this month. And this is the beginning of it. We will continue to see very dramatic increases over the next decade and a half to two decades, with very large increases in the 65 and older population. Retirements are about to explode on us, increasing very sharply. Probably some increase this year, but next year and the year after that, we'll likely see the largest increases. At the very same time that high school graduations are declining and will continue to decline throughout the decade, labor force growth is slowing, and that will likely lead to slowing economic growth, and increasing productivity will become increasingly important and eventually become the sole source of economic growth in Minnesota and the United States. Replacement job openings will increase sharply, improving opportunities for job seekers with appropriate skills. And so this is not totally a negative situation, but we will see that job replacement openings will increase sharply beginning sometime later this year and through the next couple years. Social Security and pension income will become increasingly important as a proportion of total income, and revenues are expected to grow more slowly. The boom generation begins to turn 65 this month, and this decade we will see more people turning age 65 this decade than we have for the last four decades combined. And then next decade, we will see an even greater number. And then the storm will be largely over with, at least that storm of moving people into the 65 and older category. By then, though, we will begin to see large increases in the 75 and older and 85 and older populations beginning in the 2030s. The labor force for Minnesota will begin to grow dramatically slower, and by the end of this decade, we will be at record low levels of growth in the workforce. This forecast assumes that immigration rates will remain at the levels that we have seen in the last decade, which were some of the largest that we have seen since the post-World War I period, and that people, that older workers would continue to work a bit longer, and that retirement age would increase somewhat over the decade, and both of those combined will still not stem the tide of dramatically slower rates of growth of the workforce. The importance of this, I don't think, can be understated, that there are, at the very basis of it, at the very core of economic theory, sort of first principles of economics, that there's only two ways to grow an economy. One is to increase the number of people working, and the other is to increase per worker productivity. The increase in the number of people working is going to be dramatically slowing this decade, and by the end of the decade, virtually all of our increase will be due to all of our economic growth will be due to increasing per worker productivity. This is the conundrum that Europe is facing right now. Their workforce is aging, it is beginning to decline, and they have not been pushing on increasing per worker productivity enough to cover the promises that they have made in the past. And so they are beginning to run into financial problems. The same thing is true of Japan and will soon be true of China. Replacement openings will increase dramatically and will likely exceed total job growth for most of this decade. And that will not just be in a few occupations, but it will cover a wide variety of occupations. However, the nature of these occupations is also changing, that we are beginning to notice a growing and disturbing mismatch between skills of people seeking jobs and the skills that the employers are looking for, and we believe that that will grow over the remainder of this decade and into next decade. The very nature of jobs is changing as employers are also experiencing these changes and beginning to look for increasing their per worker productivity and pushing very hard on the productivity side of the ledger. That we believe will continue throughout the next couple decades. Certain occupations will become problematic, one of which that has been noted for some time is healthcare professionals, particularly physicians, where we have, as a nation, not been training enough physicians for the last three decades to replace the current cadre, and as people retire, that will become an increasing issue with the expectation of national shortages of physicians sometime by the middle of this decade, at the very time when the demand for healthcare professionals will be increasing sharply.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gillespie, do you see a correlation between I'm just listening to you talk here. Is there a correlation between what we are teaching our children today and what the owners out there are really looking for? I mean, is there an imbalance there? Because you're making it sound like we're not teaching our children today what is really needed in the workforce.
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Perry, that has been a chronic complaint of many employers for some time, that skill levels need to, or that what students leave school with needs to be ramped up, particularly in math and language skills. That's not a new argument. One of the things that we're beginning to see now, though, is people that were laid off in the past year or two who are brought back into a workplace setting where they're no longer able to do the job because the job has basically changed and the level of expectation of training has increased. So that's it's going to occur in many different ways across all occupations and industries. It'll show up in many different ways, but it's going to show up increasingly as a mismatch between the skill set that the potential employee has and the skill set that employers are looking for.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gillespie, going back to your previous slide on occupation and replacement outnumber new job growth, do you have a slot there for government employees? Do you have a projection on how that will affect replacements and growth?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, actually, I was just getting ready to address that.
And one other question.
Senator Limmer.
You know, in our in some of what our government pays for, one of the more essential services is public safety and corrections. And if we happen to have a decrease in population, is it correct to assume that perhaps in a staggered off 10 or 15 years, should we be expecting a lower population and public commitment to the area of corrections due to a decrease in population? If, you know, statistics will show that generally a criminal population is generally defined by an age, and that their criminal activity usually falls from late teenage to perhaps, and it starts to fade off at about 39 or 42 years of age, And if we have this bubble that's going through and now all of a sudden we have a decrease in population, can we expect a reduction in that area sometime soon?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, let me address the second question first, and then I'll get to the first question. The population is not actually going to be declining. We will continue to grow at the rate at which we've been growing for the last few decades, at about 7 to 8/10 of a percent per year, but we're going to be growing a lot older. Now, the question of crime rate, normally that would indicate a reduction in crime rate. Teenagers and preteens tend to have sort of the highest rates of activity in terms of police enforcement, and then young adults would come second. Those numbers should begin to decline. In terms of the corrections population, though, one of the things that we are beginning to see now is most of the growth in the corrections population is in among their older members. And one of the issues that some states have run into, such as California, is a rapidly growing demand for geriatric prisons, prisons that have violent criminals who are beginning to experience elderly dementia and cannot be placed in regular nursing homes and must be kept in a high security but intensely medical related facility. It's very expensive. As far as the crime rate goes, that would normally suggest a decline in the crime rate over time, although there may be some counter trends, such as in Japan, where they've actually seen an increase in criminal activity among some of their older people who have committed violent crimes. So that, well, the explanation that I've read is that they can be put in prison where they will have someone to take care of them and have a place to live. For elderly people who have no other options. These are some of the darker things that could potentially happen in the future, particularly with increased family disruptions and increases in number of single residents.
Thank you. Senator Skoy and then Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gillespie, I want to return to the education question. Just briefly, isn't the issue not so much what we're teaching, is that we're not having enough people furthering their education? Some of the stuff that I've seen is that the workforce of the next decade is going to require 70% of the workers to have additional education or skill sets, and we're in the mid-40s now, and our largest problem is going to be to get these our Minnesotans to go back to school or to further their education when they graduate from high school, to fill that growing need for additional education.
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoe, Minnesota has been identified as one of the most education-intensive workforces in the world, and I believe we're already at the 70%. Requiring at least some post-high school education. The expectation is almost all new jobs that will be created will require some post-high school education. I think the going forward, we're basically looking at 100% requiring at least some training beyond the high school level. Yes, sir.
May I ask about that interplay? You know, I've read that we have so many folks that are unemployed that they are in getting new skills, they are retraining, they're back in college. Do you expect some interplay with that phenomenon, with what you're talking about now?
Madam Chair, one of the things that happens during recessions is that more students go into higher education to further their skills. That is that we've seen that and this round, and that's a very positive thing, developing the skills. The question going forward is, in a very rapidly changing environment, is having skills that are flexible enough to meet the rapid change in the demands of employers.
Thank you. We have very interested senators. We have Senator Ingebretson, Senator Michelle, and then Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Senator Ingebrigtsen.
And off of Senator Limmer's question, maybe a little more broad, if you will, I see you do have a slider with regards to state government workforce aging. I'm wondering if there is any words that we can reference or there is some information such as the public versus private, the growth of public employment over the last 10, 15 years versus private. Is there such a chart or is there such a study done? Can you help us with that? I'm talking about township, state, city, all the way through.
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, there is. Actually, the Census Bureau does a regular evaluation of state-level data, and so that we can compare state growth. It is important, for example, to remember that we have had some structural changes. For example, in 1990, the Minscue employees were not part of state government, and early on in the 1990s became part of the state government pool. So it looks like there was a very large increase in government employment, when in fact there it was really a sort of a transfer of status from one government form to another. So, you know, we do need to make sure that we make those kinds of mental adjustments in the comparison. But, yes, sir, we do have that kind of comparison.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. And to that point, then, from that point forward to where we are now, do we have an idea what the growth in government has been?
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, there has been, I believe, and I'd have to go back and double-check the numbers, a slight reduction in government employment and state government employment over the last decade or so. But I'm afraid I'd have to go back and double-check that to make sure that I just simply don't have that number off the top of my head.
Could you give me that?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Gillespie, Dr. Gillespie, thank you for being with us. And you and I have had a number of occasions to talk about your numbers. And I guess what I want to focus on with you this morning is it your take, is it your conclusion that the severity of our recent recession, some would call it a depression, but that the severity of that is such that it has fundamentally changed your demographic models and forecasts? Is this kind of something you've never seen before in economic cycles?
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, the basic demographic trends are still there. That has not changed. What changed was that the recession began in January of 2008, just at the very time that the number of people turning age 62 and becoming eligible for Social Security and beginning to move into their retirement years also began. And so this is a coincidence that is reinforced itself, and basically the recession caused us to lose about 4 years worth of revenue growth that at least according to Dr. Stinson's forecast we will not recover in the foreseeable future, and that will come at a time when economic growth and revenue growth is going to begin to slow, and that was a predictable slowing. That rate of growth, we're looking at that right now, and we will soon have a document report on that. We did look at that in 2008 with the Budget Trends Commission report, and conclude now that basically those same conclusions hold, except that we've lost about 4 years worth of revenue growth, and so basically we're starting at a lower level than we anticipated.
Well, and thank
Senator
you,
Michelle.
And Madam Chair, thank you for bringing this in front of the committee. I guess I'd encourage all of our committees to think about where Dr. Gillespie's numbers can influence and impact the decisions we need to make going forward this session. I'm not sure that there's a more critical presentation that we'll hear in any legislative committee. And, Madam Chair, remarking on the discussion we had yesterday in the Tax Committee, we had a site consultant in here comparing how Minnesota looks to businesses and job creators getting ready to expand. And it strikes me that we have set up a really difficult message. Our proposition to the world can't be we're high cost, we're getting older, and our labor force is shrinking. But I believe, you know, much of what you're telling us today would reinforce that image, that brand, and we need to work on that. There are things that we can work on as a legislature this session that's really critical for us. So I just thank you, Madam Chair. There's not a question in there.
Thank you. And Senator Bonoff, and then I just want to let members know there are some really important slides and some great information ahead, so I hope we'll let Mr. Gillespie get ahead here. But Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Gillespie, you mentioned when the question was asked about educating our workforce, you mentioned the importance of graduating our students with stronger backgrounds in math, science, and we talk about STEM a lot, but you also said languages. And I have been thinking that myself as you look at our particularly our big Fortune 500 corporations who have places all over the world where they do business, we haven't been talking about the need to have bilingual students. And I know in other countries, their students often graduate knowing two or three languages, and we have never made that a top priority. And it seems to me, with the changing marketplace, that's something that we ought to consider. Any comments?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, in my conversations with corporate recruiters, their first concern is that a person have at least one language, and apparently do, but also having an ability with a language other than English, or even just some passing. Study with that will cause most people, most young people, to think about people of different cultures and different languages a bit differently. So that if you're working on a production line and you have and the corporation has visitors from another country, that there aren't inappropriate references made and things like that. That people understand that people of different cultures may dress differently, they may sound differently, but that does not mean that they are necessarily less worthy. And that can have a large impact on a corporation's ability to grow and willingness to stay here.
Thank you. And Mr. Gillespie, I think we were at page 6 in the handout.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that, and this is sort of a preceding piece of information, just to note that incomes do tend to decline with retirements, and we will see a sharp increase in retirements. And not only will incomes decline with retirements, earning-based income, the income you receive for actually doing something, will decline, while retirement and Social Security incomes will rise sharply. That and those two elements, as well as other information, has led us to believe that revenue growth is going to be slowing at a we will still be seeing growth in revenues over the long run, but that the rate of that growth will slow dramatically. This was a graph from the Budget Trends Commission that was published in January of 2009, in which we indicated that total revenue growth in Minnesota was growing at a rate of about 6.8% in the latter part of the 90s and early part of the aughts, and over the next 25 years we are forecasting a rate of upper 3% to around 4% per annum growth in revenues. That is still a growth in revenues, but that is a substantially slower rate of growth in revenues, and that is largely due to the fact that incomes are going to be growing more slowly, and that the source of those incomes will also change from more earnings-based to more retirement and Social Security-based that are taxed at a differential rate. And it's only Dr. Wilson, the previous testifier, has also done some research on the age impact on the state income tax and has also confirmed that effect of a dramatic impact. At the same time that revenues will be growing more slowly in the future, really beginning this decade, expenditure pressures, especially for health care, will begin to increase. By approximately 2020, Minnesota will have more people over age 65 than we have kids in K-12 education. Despite the fact that K-12 education enrollments are already beginning to grow, and healthcare costs will increase sharply with population aging, including direct costs such as long-term care and other medical expenses for the elderly, but also other background costs such as higher healthcare insurance rates for teachers and government workers and other such people. This decade and next will be the periods of very large increase in the 65 and older population. This graph is essentially the same graph that will be seen nationally, and it's very similar. The crossover point is almost identical. Again, Minnesota's age structure is very similar to the national age structure, and by 2020, we will have more folks over age 65 and eligible for Social Security and Medicare than we will kids in K-12 education. Healthcare costs, not surprisingly, rises very rapidly with age. And this decade, the 55 to 64 year old age population will increase very sharply, and that will be the first big jump in healthcare expenditures. We are projecting over the next decade that healthcare cost, including medical assistance, long-term care, will be growing at a rate of about 8 to 8.5% per year in cost, and then rising to about 8.5 to 9% next decade, and then the baby boom generation begins to need long-term care. After that, this is not an issue that's going away. This is an issue that will increase, and this is the beginning of that increase is starting this year. At the same time, K-12 enrollments, after a decade of a slight decline, will begin to grow again and grow at a rate of about 1%. About 1% per year. The increase in the number of students, coupled with continued increases in students in special education and the cost of special education and teacher staff, healthcare costs, etc., will, given current law, cause an increase in education cost, roughly at about the same proportion or the same growth rate as the growth rate in overall revenues. Healthcare costs, particularly medical assistance, long-term care, and K-12 education represent a major segment of the total state general fund budget, and will be growing fairly rapidly into the long-term future. Again, these are not short-run changes. Another
Mr. Gillespie, can I just ask you, can you just say that again? What I thought I heard you say was that if given the education parameters and what's in current law, our commitments going forward will cost all of the revenue growth that's currently projected going forward. Is that, did I hear you right, or can you maybe restate it so it's better?
Madam Chair, I can't say that it would be all of the increase in revenue, but the conclusion that the Budget Trends Commission came to in 2008 before the Great Recession is that over the next 25 years, if revenues grow at about 3.9% and health care grows at about 8.5% per year, and these continue to be numbers in approximately the range that we are talking about, that would basically cover all the growth in revenues. That essentially there would be dollars left over for everything else, but it would be the same dollars that we have today. That was before a loss of 4 years of revenue growth. So what we've seen is a revenue situation that's been substantially shifted down from what this conclusion was, but that the rate of growth going forward we do not believe is going to change dramatically.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Gillespie, I appreciate your comments and your presentation. And I know we're getting to the end of our committee, but I wanted to try to ask you to bring a few things together that you'd made comments on. Early in the presentation, you talked about we've entered an age of entitlement. You made a comment talking about Europe being somewhat ahead of us on the curve, and you said that they're beginning to see some beginning to run into financial problems, which that euphemism I'd like maybe you to unpack for us a little bit. But as you presented this information here, the question that I have as a policy matter for the state, given the changes in the demographics, given the things that you're presenting, is our challenge in the legislature to find ways to raise more revenue to solve the problems of demand that are going to be put on us as a result of the entitlement culture that we have? Or is our challenge going to be to reduce those entitlements and the expectations of those going forward? What conclusion should we draw from this data that you are presenting?
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, you're asking for an opinion and a conclusion, which I want to make
Madam
sure
Chair,
that you understand
Mr.
that.
Mr. Gillespie, I'm not really asking for your opinion, but you are the guy that has the numbers, and numbers are useful, and they can be analyzed, and I'm asking you to give us an analysis of if we wanted to tax raise revenues, is it possible to do it? Or do we need to look at something else? And I understand there's somewhat of an opinion there, but to me it's an opinion that should be based on some data that you're presenting to us. And
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, the conclusion that Dr. Stinson and I came to jointly several years ago, actually, and has not changed. In fact, if anything, has been reinforced, is that this is not where our current situation is not sustainable. That we are in an unsustainable situation. We've been in an unsustainable situation for some time. We identified that back in the mid-90s with a report for Governor Carlson for exactly these reasons. So this is not a particularly new conclusion. Our conclusion is that expenditure cuts will probably be necessary. Revenue increases may be necessary, but that those probably will not be sufficient, that we need to also look for ways to increase efficiency and increase productivity in government and especially to do things in a better way, have better outcomes for what we do. Lower recidivism rate in our prison system, higher graduation rate for our high school students, and better quality high school students coming out. These will have a dramatic impact on cost going forward, as well as on economic growth going forward. That we need to think about everything that we're doing, and this is a very different situation than anything that we faced before. This is not business as usual. The coin of art, or the term of art that economists are now using, was coined by the financial people at a corporation called PIMCO, Pacific Investment Management Corporation. Bill Gross and Muhammad El Aryan coined the term the new normal. Basically, all those things that you thought were normal have gone. And that we are in a new normal situation, and that is a dramatically different situation than anything that we've seen in the past.
Well, Mr. Gillespie, other variables might be reform or economic growth or performance and results-oriented programming. Things like that might also have an interplay with the need for revenues versus the need to cut expenditures.
And Madam Chair, I don't want to. I hope that I don't leave this with the idea that this is all negative. There are great opportunities here, and there is potential for great opportunities. Our workforce is actually going to be growing, even though it's going to be growing at a slower rate. It's going to be growing a lot faster than the workforces of many of our competitive economies. We have the potential for great opportunities this decade. And so I think, you know, one option is to look at this not just as a negative thing, but as an opportunity for going forward, for making the changes that can really improve our productivity as a society.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad we could end on a positive note, Senator Roebling and members. If there aren't other questions for Mr. Gillespie, I appreciate your being here. I know the committee does, and we will draw on your expertise further in this session. Thank you so much. This hearing is adjourned.
Great stuff. We actually should.